Happy New Year with many blessings of health and wellness to all listeners. We're starting a new season with a new theme, expanding the breath, breathing restorative justice into family, society, and workplaces. We will be expanding the ideas and concepts of restorative justice, asking critical questions and peeling back layers of comfort to delve into deeper transformative practice. Please join us this season to expand what you know about RJ. Welcome back to our special two-part episode, and I still got Maida here with me. Maida, I'm going to throw it to you to give any story that we wanted that comes to mind about our experiences with school and discipline.
Sure. Thank you for having me again, Gilbert. Really grateful for just this space to converse with you, right, and to really think back to our stories, right, and what connects us to this work. So for me, I think a really profound and meaningful experience that I had growing up in regards to discipline is, I know I mentioned in the earlier episode how I grew up in a predominantly Latinx immigrant working class community. And so I think when I think of discipline and I think of a powerful story, you know, I definitely think to the time in fourth grade when I was suspended. And just to give some context, I think I've been able to kind of analyze and explore that story of when I was suspended, right, for getting in a fight. I have to contextualize it and analyze it within the framework of what it is to grow up in a community where, you know, institutions aren't always trusted. Institutions have done a lot of harm, right? Institutions meaning police, institutions meaning, you know, schools, right? And so I think about how I grew up, you know, being taught very early on, you know, that we have to protect each other. Us young people, we have to stand in solidarity with my siblings. You know, there's five of us growing up in a community where we didn't always trust adults. And then I think about my peers and how it was definitely like we had our own ways of regulating that and ensuring that, you know, nobody like told on each other, right? And we talked a lot about like ratting, right? And you just weren't supposed to rat anyone out. And it was a means of protection. And it was a means of like maintaining your connection, right? And your trust for each other and how powerful that is. And I don't think it's a negative thing. I really do think it was like how we survived and how we ensured that like we were safe, right? Because, you know, we didn't want to deal with like authoritative like figures coming to tell us or punish us, right, for our behavior. And so I think I learned a lot of amazing just like qualities within that when it comes to like loyalty, when it comes to just being down for people that you really truly care about and protecting each other, right? And it was a means of really of survival and of resistance, you know, that was, you know, a way to self-preserve, but also sometimes it did contribute to like, you know, harm sometimes, right? And so I think about that. And then I also think about how I was really, really close to my teachers growing up. And how I was fortunate enough to have teachers that, you know, I was really close with, that cared about me, that showed me that they cared about me. But how sometimes intentionally or not, you know, like they had their own biases and their own stuff to unpack. And so I was often treated as a very, you know, light-skinned Mexicana. I was often treated as like other from my own community. And so there were pieces of me that were welcomed and supported, like my academic, you know, like me doing well academically, like, and me kind of being like, you know, what you would think of as like a teacher's pet, right? In my trauma response of times to like authority, I often fell back on like appeasing, right? And just pleasing my teachers and making sure that I was like a good student. And so I, you know, I was kind of torn between this like internalizing like white culture, white supremacy, like who's considered like good enough to be supported by like the school system, right? And who was left out of that or pushed out of that. And so I think about, yeah, so I think about the time when I was in fourth grade when we had a new person come into our school, like a new student, and my homies were like, hey, I dare you to dog her, like just dog her. And when you go sharpen your pencil, right? And so I remember doing that in class and dogging this like new student who I was like, yeah, I need to like prove that I'm down for my friends. And so I thought, you know, I was super cool and I did that. And then it turns out like this new student was actually like, you know, not having it and like threatened to beat me up after school, and then started telling like everyone that, you know, she was, you know, in a gang and that her brothers were in gangs and that she had been suspended from like a few other schools because of her fighting, and you know, that it didn't end well for the other people involved. And so I was like super terrified, and I, you know, I remember going up to her and being like, you know what, like, my bad, my bad. Like, I, you know, we're cool. It's all good. Like, and she's like, well, if you're really down, like, a few days later, like, well, we all kind of started hanging out. We like brought this person into our friend group. And I remember a few days later, she was like, well, if you're really down, you know, if you're really down for us, then, you know, let's go, me and you, let's go throw down, like, let's go get in this fight, right? Let's go throw down with these twins that, ratted me out in my, I don't know, something had happened. And she's like, they had ratted me out. Like, I'm not cool with them. Like, are you down? And feeling really torn between like this, like, okay, this isn't something I usually do. I oftentimes would perform, right? Like as a means to like self-preservation, that I was really down to fight and stuff like that. And so I remember just being like, okay, sure. Yes, I got you. Like, let's do this. And getting in this fight and like, it didn't end well. It was actually really short, but it just obviously, like, the next morning I went back to school, and I remember showing up a little bit late to school and going into and being called into the office, right? Being called out of class, called into the office. Everybody's like, you gotta go to the office, you're in trouble. And showing up, and then being told that, you know, my friends had already all like disclosed that I was at fault, that I was the person who, you know, committed the harm. I was the person who was fighting these innocent, you know, girls. Like, it was just like language of like, you're the, you know, you perpetrated this harm, and like, these were the victims, and you are to blame, and you're being suspended. And I remember that nobody asked me, right? Like, nobody asked me, you know, are you okay? Or how are you feeling? Or no one cared about like how my relationships were affected with my friends and the other people involved, the twins involved. No one asked me about my needs. And no one asked me like, you know, what's been going on since, or like, what have you thought about since this happened? And so it was like an experience that really marked me, right? Because not only that, like, I was suspended immediately. I wasn't given any voice. And then going home, I remember my mom went to pick me up, and then going home, like, she didn't talk to me the whole time. So like, she also kind of like supported the school's approach to like isolating me and like not really giving me a chance to express anything. And then I remember sitting in a room for like 3 days. And of course, my mom, given that she's like amazing and just like always about nurturing us and caring for us, and she always fed us like really, really well, like home-cooked meals. Like, that was really the only like human need that I had, is like shelter, of course, food. But like, I was isolated, right? I was excluded from my school community for a few days. I was excluded from my family. And I remember specifically that she put me in her room, right? And she wanted me to be alone in there, because it would have been rewarding me if she allowed me to stay in my own room within my own comfort with my little sister, who I shared a room with. Instead, it was like isolation was like the remedy, right? And the means to correct my behavior, as well as like que hacer, right? Like chores. And she gave me like a huge pile of clothes in a hamper. And it was like everyone's clothes in my family. I'm talking there's seven of us, right? Including my parents. And was like, here, you're just going to iron. And so just like this punishment on multiple layers that happened. And like how it's like, you know, like discipline came from all the adults, right, involved. And it was just like a working together to make sure that I was like paying for this you know, for this incident, for this harm that I had done, right? And then I remember going back to school and there was no mention of it. It was like as if nothing ever happened. Nobody brought it up again. It was just kind of like, okay, she's back, like everything's cool again, you know, or it's all good, right? It really definitely marked me, and it really informed the way that I look at discipline and that I look at this work that we do. Mm-hmm. Gilbert, I would love to hear, you know, what story you have in connection to discipline and your own experience.
Thanks, Meta. Thanks for sharing that story. You know, so you mentioned trauma response as a piece, and that is very similar to mine as well. The piece or fun, it's also called. And as an adult, particularly as a RJ practitioner who trains and lives in these concepts and ideas, I think that the reason why I most likely had in particular that fawn or appease response, which is, we often think of the three Fs, the flight, fight, freeze, and sometimes we don't often include the fawn or appease, which is to accommodate or to comply as a means to not be given negative attention or to a situation, you know, as a means for safety. And so for that was definitely my response behavior. I think because my dad was very loud and emotionally and psychologically abusive at times in the household. And so to be noticed meant to be disciplined or to be given attention that wasn't positive. And so I think for me, the only thing I can really remember is having, you know how like there was a card, you got to pull the card if you did a negative behavior or whatever. I don't remember what I did or what grade, but just the act of fingers on the card, sliding it out from the envelope and placing it in a different color, in a color that represented like that was a bad choice. And just, I guess, naming like the feeling of shame. Maida, is there anything that you could share that we could talk about around the historic uses of discipline in schools?
Some things that like come to mind is like for sure thinking about how historically the way that like behaviors are policed, right? And just like expression is policed. So, but just I'm thinking about how like historically, like the history of education is very much how it's designed, right? As like a capitalist, or as an arm of capitalism, right? And as an arm of kind of ensuring that the status quo is maintained. And so I think with that comes discipline, which is to kind of regulate and ensure that the social classes are maintained, to make sure that folks kind of, depending, you know, mediated by race, class, gender, and ability, right? And like the identities that are privileged in our society, you know, discipline has also been a force of the school to ensure the status quo, the maintaining of the status quo. And so knowing that context and knowing that schools were designed that way, like it's no surprise that like historically schools have been the institution where Black youth are, you know, criminalized, Black bodies are criminalized for the first time, right? It's no surprise that there is such a thing as the school to prison pipeline, and that oftentimes our young people, the first time that they have any interaction with law enforcement is in their school communities. I think about like LGBTQ youth have really high rates of being pushed out of school. I use the term push out intentionally because I think, you know, growing up with hearing dropout, like students dropping out, which is something that was used a lot to talk about my community of working class Latinx immigrant youth. Brown youth, right? And how it's intentional to say push out because there's obviously forces, right, that have worked and operated to create really unsafe climates and environments that make it sometimes better for students to completely leave those institutions. Sometimes there's agency and choice, and but all of this is situated within the context of like systems that are, you know, working to ensure that the capitalist status quo is maintained. And thinking about, you know, mass incarceration and, you know, the problem in this country with mass incarceration, especially when it comes to like Black men, right, predominantly, and also like a growing population of Black women who are being incarcerated, and Latinx communities, right, that are being incarcerated and targeted, particularly Latinx men. It's, you know, it's no coincidence that schools have historically worked hand in hand with that system to ensure a supply of a cheap labor force that works within our jail system. Thinking about like people who are differently abled or people with disabilities, and how historically like they have also been disciplined and othered through the use of placing them in separate, you know, special education classes that oftentimes offer like lower level like curriculum, right? Like not really offering like the same like academic opportunities and rigor that like other students have.
I think one thing too that I'm also curious about is the ways in which shame and corporal punishment have been used as a means to for compliance and for control and for power as a status quo, as a means to make sure that all of the systems that you just mentioned are put into place individually. And so I think about the stories that my dad has of where the paddle was used, where like being struck, being hit, the paddle, the ruler, being struck on the knuckles, being hit in the back of the hands, like the back of the knees, like the back of the thighs, the back of the neck. And, you know, and then we could even go back even further around the dunce cap and a student being, having to sit on a stool in the corner of a classroom facing the wall wearing a pointy hat. And just all the means in which isolation, shaming have all been a means in order to get students to comply. And then when we continue to talk about trauma, how a brain, a body that has been through various traumas, that compliance is not an option or an ability within whatever is being asked. I think a conversation around school and discipline has to have both of these, or all of these ideas in mind, particularly when we move into what RJ says. And so in the traditional discipline, I'll name the traditional discipline, and then if you can name what RJ says. So in our presentations and our introduction to this work, we have these two boxes, these two charts, and on one is traditional discipline, and the other is RJ. And I always sort of see them as like these two beings and how these two beings speak to one another or to an audience. And in the traditional discipline, the response is, who broke the rule? What rule was broken? Who broke it? What punishment is deserved? And how long should the rule breaker be excluded from the community? When we ask teachers and adults, what experience have you had most of in these two paradigms, hands almost always go up in terms of people naming and claiming that they've had much more experience in the five questions that I just named. And so RJ is trying to give a different response. And so I'll pass it to you to read and to name what RJ is attempting to do or say or ask.
Yeah, definitely. I do want to add that with our parents and caregivers, right, when we talk about traditional discipline in their parenting or the way that they were parented, right, in their own caregivers, when we talk about traditional versus like restorative justice, like there's also like that sentiment, right, in their own, you know, upbringing, going through school, but also in their own just like growing up and sometimes what they fall back on because of that trauma and that like conditioning, you know, is on the traditional, but like wanting to actively work towards like the restorative way, doing a lot to work in that way. But oftentimes under stress or, you know, in hard times, like it, you know, it's they have to actively work to be more restorative and like think those ways. Right. So I just want to name that and kind of shout them out for that powerful work that they've also been doing. Right. And so the restorative justice, the set of questions that restorative justice asks when it comes to discipline is, who was harmed? What relationships have been harmed? What are the needs and responsibilities of all of those affected? And how do all affected parties come together to address the needs, and what agreements can be made to repair the harm?
So fully stepping into the RJ work, Maida, what's like two promising practices or examples that you've seen or that you've participated in that incorporate parents and this paradigm of RJ?
Yeah, so I think one of the most promising practices that come to mind is when we come together with parents and we, you know, build community with with our partners, right? We have partners all over Los Angeles County. And when we've worked with communities, it's like definitely partnering with folks that have a really good rapport with their parent communities, with communities of parents, where there's already a strong community and strong trust, right? And kind of working with them to co-facilitate and to lead some of this work with parents, you know, centering the leadership of parents. And one of the most powerful kind of like dialogues that we've been able to kind of facilitate and create in community and circle or in workshops to explore, you know, what was it for us? What was it for our younger selves, right? When we think about, you know, we want to intervene in behaviors that young people are partaking in, maybe like self-harm behaviors around substance use or like ditching school or, you know, behaviors that parents are concerned about, it's like taking it back to like our younger selves, right? So asking parents like, you know, questions, like checking questions and questions in circles around, you know, what was it, what were you like as in your younger self? When you were 15, 16, 17 years old, you know, what was your favorite outfit, right? What, like, when were you most feeling yourself? Or what was your favorite type of music, right? And so that's been a really promising practice, because it just changes the spirit in the space. It just shifts the room. And so as adults, right, working on our own adultism, working on our own like internalized, you know, conceptions of discipline and what's appropriate and what, you know, what's the right way to discipline young people. It's like inviting in our younger selves has been really, really powerful to just be like, you know, to hear some of the parents talk about, you know, I was such a rebel. I was such a traviesa. It's like a word that I hear a lot, a traviesa, a travieso. I didn't listen to nobody. I had it all figured out. And it just changes the spirit. It brings a lot of joy and laughter into the experience. And a lot of like trusting of the agency of their young people in these conversations. And so I think for me, as like someone who has been institutionalized through academia and like research and wanting to be like, you know, harm reduction approaches are this, and this is how we should approach, like, right, in ways that we don't perpetuate more harm, right? It's like really just creating space for them to really reconnect with that deep knowledge and wisdom that they've always held, right? And like kind of reconnecting with that, bringing in that young person, and it just changes everything, right? And so that's been super powerful, is just like creating the space and the environment and dropping in those questions. Has been a super promising practice, I think, in terms of like centering the agency and the power that our parents bring with them, right? And then one other promising practice that I want to uplift is with school partners who have really strong relationships with their parents, who really trust that their parents contribute a lot to creating more restorative environments and restorative climates within the school, right? Knowing that restorative justice as it exists, I think, in like LAUSD, right, which is like a district that we work with a lot, thinking about the history of parent involvement and parent leadership and parent activism to ensure that climates be changed, that disproportionate disciplinary practices be addressed, right? And so I think about that, like the Climate Bill of Rights that was passed, I believe, in 2013, right? Because of the leadership of our parents, of our agencies, right? That organizations, super powerful organizations, right? That came together to ensure that that happened, right? I think about how, you know, some of our school partners, you know, as they're working with us through these longer term contracts to ensure that, you know, they create the culture shift necessary to really name that they are a school that embodies restorative justice values. You know, the best practices I've seen is when they include parents in that work, when parents are also joining in to those conversations, right? When parents are also like participating in trainings and workshops, in dialogue, right? Forums to be able to name, you know, the changes that they want to see in those school communities, right? Where the teachers oftentimes look like the students, right, and can connect with the cultural background of their students. And so with that, like, I think one of the schools that comes to mind for me is Burlington, right? Burlington, Camino Nuevo Burlington, which is a school that we've been working with for several years now, and I had the privilege of working with them in the last year, where, you know, leading some workshops with some of the, you know, with Kim, who's the vice principal there, and Alonso, who's the parent coordinator, and just seeing, like, the level of parent involvement, right, and the level of participation and the willingness to, like, share story and unpack, right, their own histories with, like, you know, traditional versus restorative discipline, or unpacking, like, white supremacist notions of, you know, positive youth development, and thinking about, like, what are some indigenous, right, paradigms that we can explore, and, like, connecting with them and being able to be like, hey, that speaks to, like, that's me, and, like, infusing their own stories, right, and how they grew up with some of that, and how empowering that felt, right? And so I think it's, like, all of these things, like, culturally, being culturally relevant, building community, being vulnerable. Like, I saw Kim and Alonso, and, you know, I definitely worked at, like, just making sure that we were, like, all, like, in it together with, like, circle practice. And one of the most powerful moments, I think, that I had there was this time when, you know, we were starting out in circle, and then their principal came into the room. We were bumping some cumbias, right, as we're getting started, and the principal comes in and just starts dancing in the middle of the room, just getting down with this cumbia move. And the parents were like, yeah, and they're all dancing too. And, like, I just think it's like that to me was like that is the work. Like, that is, I think once, like, Kim was like, oh, we have a guest presenter here, Mayra, and he got kind of shy and backed away, but it was just like to be able to witness, right? Like, pushing back on power dynamics, pushing back on, like, authority and who's in charge, and just experiencing joy together and being in community, I think was just, like, such a beautiful teaching, right? And a beautiful just kind of experience and an embodiment of what it is to, like, really embrace restorative justice values within a school community, and, like, and then, like, connecting with parents and ensuring that, like, you know, everyone's voice is in it, and everyone's, like everyone's invited to bring their whole humanity into the space, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, bro, that site is a site that we've been working with for a long time, like you mentioned, and, you know, they've had a strong parent program for a long time, and so their culture is super sustainable in so many levels. For Mayra, for schools that may not have as great or a pre-existing parent program or culture, what are some ways, or what are some things that schools can do to incorporate parents into this work and into culture building?
I think that, so just kind of learning from our partners who are at different levels of this that you're naming, right, is unpacking and knowing that historically institutions and schools in particular, you know, have been part of the colonial project, have been part of, like, perpetuating harms on communities of color. And so I think definitely lots of opportunity for, like, teacher training, admin training on, like, understanding that, unpacking that work, and then working from that place of, like, okay, so what are some elements of, you know, trauma-informed work, right? Being trauma-sensitive. And so it's, like, recognizing those harms, recognizing that, you know, oftentimes, like, or historically schools have worked to kind of, from this deficit model of looking at families, right? Of, like, you know, sometimes parents are seen as the problem of social issues, are seen as, like, what we're going to blame when it comes to systemic inequities. And so it's, like, unpacking that work, that anti-bias work, that understanding power and privilege and the history of this country, and, you know, its roots of slavery and imperialism, colonization, is definitely some of the work that needs to be done, I think, on a ideological kind of level in terms of the roots of all of that. And then I think in terms of actions, it's like, okay, so, like, recognizing that, so what are some ways to center the voice of parents, really listen to what they have to say, creating space for their voices to be heard, and actually working to implement some of those changes as well, right? Supporting the leadership. And then it's also just like a lot of outreach. I think lessons learned is like, do all the phone calls, making sure that, you know, parents are informed of what is going on in the school community, upcoming events, opportunities to engage, right? And then I've seen schools have like a hub of parent leaders who are very actively involved, and then like supporting their leadership to continue to reach out to other parents, right? And invite them and say, hey, these are the experiences we're having. These are the, you know, opportunities that we found to like maybe have a cafecito with the principal, right? I've seen like cafecitos with the principal if you want to ask any questions. And being able to like create the structure where those parents can then reach out to other parents, right? And share those positive experiences to then like invite others so that parents feel empowered and feel like their voice matters and that there is an impact if they engage, if they put energy and time towards the school, that it's going to be that it's really going to be taken seriously and respected, and that it's actually going to inform the school climate and the practices within the school. Mm. Those are some of the positive, you know, practices that I've seen our schools engage with when they struggle with parent participation.
Why are parents important to the implementation of restorative justice in schools?
I think parents are important for numerous reasons. So as I named before, they have been instrumental in bringing restorative justice practices to our schools. They are part of that history, and we need to recognize them as such. Mm-hmm. I also think they're important to the implementation of RJ work in schools, because we all kind of have to work together, right? So we named earlier the traditional versus the restorative discipline questions, a set of questions. And I think with a lot of the work that I've been able to do with parents, that I've been fortunate to do with parents, it's like, you know, recognizing that this concept of like the revolution starts at home, and this concept of educación, right? So something that I think about in terms of educación, I think is bigger than what schools got to teach us, and, you know, academic education, it's bigger than that, right? It's like educating on how to be, not what to be. It's like how to be in the world. That happens in the home. And so if we really recognize that, if we really cherish that for what it is, then we think about how it's like, if schools are operating or trying to move towards more restorative ways of discipline, then we have to recognize that parents are a big part of that as well. Right? That parents are supported with spaces to come together, to build community, to unpack their own traumas around, you know, how were they brought up, right? In terms of how expression was policed, right? The gender binary was policed. The way that, you know, substance use or behaviors growing up were policed, and like unpacking and undoing some of those harms, doing some of that healing work, to then like be empowered in their solidarity with each other and their connection with each other, to then move towards like more restorative ways, right? To like interrupt cycles that are rooted in like systems of oppression, right? And like us internalizing those like in our bodies and our practices and our minds, and undoing some of that work really starts with our parents, right? And so it's been super powerful to witness our parents who do that work, who are on that journey, right? And how, you know, if our teachers are doing it and our administrators are doing it, but our parents don't have opportunities to do that, or vice versa, then it's like, you know, how can we really move as a society towards just creating more restored environments for our young people, just generally, whether it be in their homes, communities, schools, and all these institutions that, you know, kind of need to be working together. And the family is a really powerful institution and a microcosm of a lot of the things that we see systemically and that we see in other, you know, maybe more powerful structures that exist.
You know, Michael, the way that you modeled, the way that you showed empathy for your parents, the acknowledgement of their resiliency in our first conversation is really such a crucial, I think, step in this work. And that reflection and that critical reflection, and also naming that I didn't hear that reflection from you until you named some of the stories about your parents and your grandparents. And so bringing it back to the call to action from this episode around interrogating our own stories, knowing our own narratives, asking questions of our own selves, which is what this work is asking us to do. When we sit in circle, we respond to questions. When we engage in a sort of dialogue, we respond to questions about who was harmed, what happened at the time. When we sit in harming conflict circles, we also respond, we listen to questions, we listen to the story of the persons harmed and the person who did the harm based on questions asked. And so again, so much of this work is steeped in storytelling and in vulnerability, which is why there's the continued, and the acknowledgement of the roots of trauma and the systems of power and oppression that influence all of us. Is there anything else to add about your work with parents or anything that you would like to call in for adults, educators, school site staff around what more or what they could be doing around school and discipline?
Yeah, I think the last thing I want to say is just encouraging and calling our just like folks in positions and in institutions and schools to really connect with parent leaders in their communities, to connect with coalitions, powerful organizing groups in our communities, you know, fighting for economic justice, immigrant rights, housing justice organizers, you know, oftentimes their parents who are doing this work, right, and creating just like better futures for all of us. And I think like having strong networks, you know, across like organizations, nonprofits, coalitions, schools, right, to really continue to support the leadership of parents, right, to not think of parents as a barrier or an obstacle to doing this work, but rather as agents who are instrumental to this work, I think is like something that I really want to emphasize that is enormously just like important for everyone, and to really think of the school as just like a hub within like broader communities and broader like ecosystems, right? And just like kind of blurring the walls of the school, right? And to really center the histories of parent movement, of parent leadership, and really supporting more and more parents in their own, like in their own school communities, to be a part of the shifts that we need to see in social justice and in ensuring better futures for our young people within and outside of the school.
Thank you, Maida, for joining me in this conversation, for all the wisdom that you dropped and for all the stories that you gave.
Thank you so much, Gilbert. It's been such an honor and a privilege to sit with you and to be part of this beautiful project that is doing this podcast with you and giving me the opportunity to share and unpack some of my stories, but also to uplift the amazing parents that I've been fortunate to work with. And lastly, just want to shout out all of my amazing facilitators who have been part of this project that is Raising Futures, who have been a big part of why, you know, we've had so much impact and success with, you know, reaching out to our parents and creating powerful space together.
This has been What You Know About RJ, sharing stories and skills about restorative justice. Thank you so much for listening. Please take a breath, do some movement. Remember to take care of yourself, to be as resilient as you can be. And thank you for listening again. Don't forget to like and subscribe. Please come hear us again. Thank you.